Please call the next case.
Lambert versus Commonwealth, Robert M. Gavelbeck, appellant, counsel, Virginia B. Tyson, here, Assistant Attorney General Rachel L. Yates, Assistant Attorney General Appellee's Counsel.
Good morning.
Morning.
May it please the court, I'm Robert Gavelbeck. I represent Mr. Lambert on this appeal from the Circuit Court of Russell County and the Virginia Court of Appeals. Mr. Lambert, first thing I'd like to do is incorporate my opening brief into my argument. Lambert was convicted of DUID, driving while under the influence of drugs, and manslaughter while DUID. The issue here involves the interpretation of that part of 18.2266 of the Virginia Code dealing with driving while under the influence of drugs. This court has previously said in the Jackson case that in order for one to be convicted under that statute, which is also part of the manslaughter statute, that the drugs have to have been self-administered. Now, this court has stated that that is, in fact, an element of the offense. In Jackson, he went to the emergency room. When he went to the emergency room, it was for pain. He went there voluntarily. The doctor ordered that he get a shot of a narcotic. He took that narcotic voluntarily in that setting where he went, and then he was also given fenugreek for nausea in the event he should have nausea as a result of the drugs he had taken. The drug, which was the narcotic, was actually injected into him by a nurse. He was given instructions about having a ride home and the like, but went out, drove, had an accident, was convicted of DUID, went to the Virginia Court of Appeals, which upheld his conviction, and then came to this court, and that conviction was overturned because this court said you had to read the plain meaning of the statute and give each word in the statute meaning.
But the decision that was made by our court, as Judge O'Brien said in the published opinion in this case, was not what the scope of the expression self-administered was, narrow or broad, you know, medical versus non-medical, injected versus pill. We didn't get into anything like that. The only thing we talked about was responding to the Attorney General's argument in Jackson that there was a particular phrase, the phrase anti-narcotic drug, that was not, the argument was that was not modified by the self-administered drug phrase, and we said it was modified by it. Yes. And there was no further debate, so we didn't say a word further. So is it really true that the Court of Appeals, you know, defied Jackson, or did the Court of Appeals quite carefully read it?
I think they overruled it. As a matter of fact, if you look in Lexis at this point, it's got a yield sign next to it because of this case. Now, I think what's important and what hasn't been considered at this point by the Commonwealth is the court not only said that it was an element of the offense, but the court had two things it could do at that point. Number one, it could remand it to the lower court to make a determination whether the drug was self-administered.
But the Attorney General was not contesting in that case. There was no assignment of there was no argument by the appellee in that case that, okay, if I'm wrong on this and if self-administered is a modifier of the phrase any narcotic drug, then this is not self-administered because self-administered really just means voluntary versus involuntary. That was never discussed, never briefed, the best I can tell, and certainly it's not in the opinion. So maybe the editors at Lexis were a little jumping the gun on this.
Well, Your Honor, when the court dismisses a case, then that means that this court found that he was not guilty of the offense.
No, it means we've addressed whatever we said we addressed in the opinion and nothing more.
But you still have the option of remanding the case or dismissing the case.
So we should have, the AG was not arguing that the particular medically administered drug was outside the scope in that case of self-administered. So we would have had to make an argument the appellant wasn't making, and then rule in the appellate, sorry, appellee, make an argument the appellee wasn't making, and then rule in the appellee's favor. Why would we do that? And even if we wanted to, why should we do something like that?
If the court didn't think that the administration of the drug in Jackson's case was self-administered or could not make that determination, then the court should not have dismissed the case.
Well, I think a lot of things in cases that advocates are not arguing, but that doesn't free me up to just rule on issues that are not brought before it.
I think the court has the option at any time to either dismiss or remand, unless it's a case of double jeopardy. And in this case, it would not have been a case of double jeopardy. This court could have remanded it.
Okay, so if Jackson means what it says, a drug, as Judge O'Brien said in this case, a drug dealer could walk up to a drug addict and shoot a shot of heroin into the addict with the addict's permission, at the addict's request, with the addict paying for the shot of heroin, and then the addict climbs in a car and runs over somebody, and the addict would say, well, I'm not guilty of DUI because it was injected.
No, sir, because first of all, once he admitted that, he or she admitted that, they would be admitting to, number one, possession of the heroin, you now have a corpus delicti because it's in his system, his or her system, and he'd also be guilty of distribution of the substance because he is
so
principal in second degree
DUI,
for that distribution.
I'm talking about a DUI of the, not the dealer, but of the addict. And the addict says, I had a DUI, but I'm not responsible for my DUI because it was injected by my dealer, and I didn't do it because it was not self-administered.
And under those circumstances, that person would be admitting to worse offenses than DWI.
Okay, but could he be found guilty of DUI? Because that's the issue we're trying to decide.
I believe that under those circumstances, the court could say that was self-administered because, number one, it's an illegal narcotic, and number one, he is admitting that he actually asked the person to give it to him. So it's not in a medical setting.
So in this setting, did Mr. Lambert ask for the methadone treatment?
What?
Did Mr. Lambert voluntarily ask for it, or was it forced upon him?
Okay. That's one of the things that is not in the record and that the Commonwealth never proved, which I think is essential to the case. They never called anyone in from the clinic. They never called anyone in to say how the dose was given. Dr. Kuhlman, who is their expert in the case, stated that it has medical purpose and is not only used to get off of narcotics, it's also used to treat pain. He also talked about the other two drugs and how they are used. And with regard to the second drug, alprazolam, he didn't even say what form it comes in or how it can be administered. So here you have a drug that the doctor says is a legal drug used for other purposes. And in answer to your question, you don't know based on the record. I may know, but you don't know based on the record whether he was going to the methadone clinic as a result of being told to by a doctor, and whether the drug was administered by needle.
Well, why couldn't the jury have said, I don't know either, but I'm sitting in the jury room and I say to myself, you know what, the first thing he said when the cops came to him is, I don't have any drugs on me at all. I don't have any drugs, haven't taken any drugs. Next thing you know, he's got Xanax, methadone, and something else in him. Why couldn't they have said, you know what, gentlemen, I don't even know that the guy even went to a methadone clinic. He says he did, but who's to say he did? In fact, I don't believe him at all. I disbelieve him, particularly since he lied about having drugs to begin with. He probably got it on the street, which is certainly a reasonable inference. It wasn't anything other than self-administered. Why couldn't a jury say that?
Well, I think that misconstrues the question that was actually asked, because the first question that the trooper asked was whether he was on any drugs, which implicates to me, have you taken any drugs? The next question he asked when he came back is, do you have any drugs in your system prescribed by a doctor? And that's when he said, I did just come back from the methadone clinic. And he said, I had a methadone treatment. The police officer, the trooper, never asked him any other questions after that. And I'd like the court to keep in mind, the test results came back like 3 months after. The officer could have gone to my client and never read him his Miranda rights after he came back and talked to him about it. When this court decided Bland versus City of Richmond, there was, as I understand it, I wasn't a lawyer, there was a big hue and cry about, well, how are we going to show that somebody who had an accident and is out of the car was drinking before the accident? So what happens now during the investigation, the officer simply asks, when was it you had your last drink? Without thinking, the person in the car states, well, I had it while I was in Bristol, and now they're at Claypool Hill in Tazewell County. So you know they didn't drink anything afterwards. In this case, 2 months elapsed from the time the testing came in until the indictment. My client didn't even know he was under investigation. The officer could have gone to him at any time and asked him, were you at the methadone clinic? What drugs were in your... We showed these drugs are in your system. How did they get there? I mean, it was just... they could have investigated further. It's not supposed to be easy to convict someone beyond a reasonable doubt. You have to do an investigation. They took, I think, the easy way out by never questioning him.
Did the methadone clinic administer the Xanax?
We don't know. And the Valium, by the way, I don't think matters, because the doctor said it had no effect in this. It's the alprazolam that would have caused the
So let's just think about Xanax for a minute. To follow up on your pragmatic view, which is very helpful to understand, would a prosecutor who has a case where the guy has got Xanax to the point he can't drive anything, but he runs into someone and he's got a DUI with an accident, the prosecutor would have to what? Say he has high levels of Xanax, has an expert saying, yes, clearly affects his ability to drive, he's clearly under the influence of this drug. What would the prosecutor have to do? Go to all of the Walmarts, or rather the Walgreens and Rite Aids, to find out if there was some prescription and refute the possibility that it was given to him by a doctor?
No, sir. One thing you can do is ask the individual. The other thing you can do is you can ask Dr. Coleman, who is the expert who comes to our area, how the drug is administered. Is it administered in a liquid form that could be injection, or is it a pill? And the doctor would likely answer, although I can't answer for him, he would likely answer, yeah, it comes in 0.25 milligrams, 0.5 milligrams, 1 milligram, 2 milligram, and 5 milligram pills. Okay. Well, if it's a pill, it's not going to be injected into your system. You can even ask the doctor, how is this drug most often taken? Is it taken by mouth or is it given by shot?
So is a shot not self-administered, but a pill is?
Depends on who gives it.
So if the guy had gone to the methadone clinic and got a methadone pill, so to speak, as opposed to a methadone injection or methadone anything, or a methadone cup, we would distinguish between getting the cup, getting the pill, from getting a shot for purposes of this statute. That's what that
I think you would. I think once he puts it in his hand and puts it in his mouth, that's self-administered. Yes, sir. I do. I think it's very narrow. And one other thing, the Commonwealth thinks this is so hard, the easiest thing to do, which they could have done after Jackson, I'm going to reserve whatever time I have after this, but the easiest thing they could have done is, and they haven't, they could have gone to the legislature and asked the legislature to make that an exception to the statute. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Virginia Tyson for the Commonwealth. The statutes that are involved in this case involve public safety on our highways. And there are three critical points that we'd like to address with regard to the self-administration provision in the DUID statute and why the evidence was sufficient here. First, what constitutes self-administration is now squarely before the court. It was not before the court in Jackson. Secondly, a defendant should shoulder some burden of production, because many cases, unlike this one, do not occur in structured situations. And thirdly, the record in this case contains a couple of admissions. Number one, on page 484 of the joint appendix, during the jury conference, the defense acknowledges that the Xanax was self-administered, that the Xanax and the Valium metabolite were self-administered. And then on page 518 of the joint appendix, where counsel is addressing the jury, the argument to the jury is...
What was that site that you just...
518 for the second one, 484 for the first one, Your Honor. On page 518, where counsel is addressing the jury, says, we don't know if the methadone was self-administered, and we don't know when the Xanax was taken. So these are the three areas that we would like to address. The assignment of error in Jackson, just to take care of exactly what was before the court, and I have gleaned this from the opinion and also just from the Commonwealth's brief, I have not seen the defendant's brief, was that the assignment of error, as assigned in the petition in Jackson, was that the court erred in ruling that 18.2.266 prohibits driving under the influence of narcotic which was not self-administered. So the issue before the court was whether self-administered applied to narcotic or just the drugs that came after the word self-administered. And this court ruled that every drug had to be self-administered. And that was the question before the court. Anything more than that in that opinion is dicta, and it is not binding. And as the example that we used on brief is like Serafin, where this court in Enriquez had highway, and that was, it was dicta. And so when Serafin came along, it did not apply. And so the issue now before the court is whether the voluntary consumption of methadone as part of a treatment program equals self-administration. And the Court of Appeals said yes, and the Court of Appeals was correct in saying yes. And when we look, as I mentioned before, about the goal of this statute, protecting the public, I think the example that the Court of Appeals used was a very instructive one. If, in fact, self-administered is defined by this court, or the legislature interprets what the legislature meant to be, that you had to absolutely take the medication and put the needle in your own arm or put the pill on your own tongue, this is going to be inconsistent with the goal of protecting the public, because unlike the structured situation here where you have a methadone clinic and it might be possible to bring someone in to testify, in the vast majority of cases where we have the abuse of a narcotic and someone gets in the car and drives, that knowledge of how exactly that narcotic was introduced into that person's body is peculiarly within the knowledge of the person who is ingesting the drug. And yes, the DUID statute does not expressly say unless it is not self-administered, but effectively, that is how this statute works. If you did not self-administer it, then that is something peculiarly within your knowledge, and you could use that as an affirmative defense. But when you have the presence of the drugs in the bloodstream, and there's the driving, and in this case, there is a fatal accident that results because of the driving under the influence, then the Commonwealth has borne its burden by showing the presence of these narcotics, the intoxicants in the drug, and it is for the person who ingested the drug to shoulder some burden of production that it was not. And the example of the prescription, I think, is also instructive. We know that to possess any drug that's on a schedule, and by the way, methadone is a Schedule II narcotic, so if you don't have a prescription for that, that's illegal as well. But in order to legally possess some drugs that are on the schedules, you must have a prescription. And the Court of Appeals in the Williams case, as we noted, ruled that it's not up to the Commonwealth to go to every pharmacy and discount store and prison infirmary to determine whether you had a prescription. If you've got a prescription, you bear the burden of production of that prescription. And so in this case, we have got three drugs in the system. And the expert, Dr. Kuhlman, testified that two of them were significant. The methadone, and by the way, he did testify, I believe it's 383, that the amount of methadone was consistent with drug dependence treatment. It would be high for pain, but for drug dependence treatment, it was not out of line, I believe, was his testimony on that page. He also, by the way, on page 391 of the joint appendix, indicated that methadone is most often given orally. He couldn't say 100%. It was never given in a shot, but in response to Mr. Galifax's point. And so we know that there is methadone in the blood system. We know there is Xanax in the blood system. And these are the concerning drugs involved in this case because they are both central nervous system depressants. And the Xanax amount was fairly high as well. And so actually, as I mentioned before, since counsel argued to the jury and also in the jury instruction conference, that the question about the Xanax was when, not how. There really wasn't a dispute about the Xanax. And if you look at 182-266, the statute prohibits the driving while under the influence of a narcotic or other drug or intoxicant or a combination of drugs. We have a combination of drugs that are here. And so the issue before the court of whether this drug was self-administered, I think it really narrows down to whether the methadone was self-administered. But I think that there is certainly an admission that the Xanax was self-administered, and that would have been a combination, in combination with the methadone.
Is that enough? Is that enough to support the conviction?
I think that it is, Your Honor, given the language of 182-266 with regard to the combination of drugs. This was a drug that was in combination with others, and our expert was concerned about the Xanax and the methadone. The expert was not concerned about the metabolite of Valium. He said, actually, it has a very long half-life or shelf life and could have been taken much earlier. So I think, yes, once we have that one of these drugs was self-administered, the Xanax, I think that is sufficient. We know the methadone was also in the blood system and that methadone is also a central nervous depressant. And of course, just the evidence. I know there was a facial trauma involved in the accident, but the EMT, who was also a nurse, was concerned that his lethargy and slurred speech and hanging onto the guardrail was something more than a facial trauma. And so she recommended that there be a blood draw. I mean, these drugs impacted his ability to drive, and he caused a fatal accident because of that. What we do know from the record is not exactly how this defendant ingested methadone. What we know from Dr. Kuhlman is that most often the methadone is taken orally. What we know from Donna Turner is that the methadone clinic there in Russell County does what's called face dosing, and that face dosing, as in line with the questions that were asked of Ms. Turner, indicate that you take the medication in front of the staff at the methadone clinic. And so that's the evidence that we have.
Can I stop you right there? Because one of the things that I find curious is you said that self-administered doesn't mean that you have to put the needle in your arm or put the pill in your mouth. So doesn't it also mean that if somebody is standing there, a doctor standing there and tells you to take a pill, does that mean that it's not self-administered?
It is self-administered, Your Honor. I think that the way the Court of Appeals dealt with this issue is actually very helpful in that even though it's more than just voluntary, you have to voluntarily participate in getting that medication or that drug into your blood system. But it is not simply that you must be the absolute last, the last thing that happens. You don't have to be the person who injects yourself or puts the pill on your tongue, because, you know, giving the usual situation, the example that the Court of Appeals used with the heroin users, that in that regard, you could ask someone else to give you that shot of heroin. You could go drive and not be guilty of driving under the influence of drugs, because even though you asked for it, you volunteered for it, you were happy that it happened, you wouldn't have self-administered it. And that cannot be the definition the General Assembly intended, given the purpose of this statute, which is to protect the safety on our highways.
Well, I just wonder whether the gate swings the other way. I certainly understand that argument, but I'm wondering if that's the case, say, for instance, in the instance in Jackson, if the person had been given a syringe by the nurse and says, look, you're squeamish, I'm squeamish, you need to inject yourself with this medication, you know, and then he gets in the car, does Jackson have a different outcome? Because he self-administered, even though it was under the supervision of a medical professional?
I think under those circumstances, it would be self-administration as well. I think when it's not self-administered, Your Honor, and if I misunderstand your question, I'm sorry. I think when it's not self-administered is when you are not aware of what is going into your body. You are rejecting it. You're not consenting to it. You're not doing anything to participate in the ingestion of that drug.
Like being at a bar and someone slips something in your drink while you're looking the other way.
And I think that is precisely what the General Assembly wanted to be sure, that there was not criminalization of driving after a situation like that. You are not responsible. You did not participate. You did not voluntarily ingest.
Can I ask you this?
Hold on a second. I'm sorry. But doesn't that mean that Jackson was wrong? Because the person consented to having that shot being given to them, even though somebody else did it.
I think that the court didn't decide that issue in Jackson. I think all the court was deciding in Jackson was, what does the phrase self-administered apply to? What does it modify? Does it modify only these drugs or these drugs? And again, I think that the fact that it was reversed and dismissed, and I have thought about that actually ahead of today, that it was because that issue was not there. Whether it was conceded away, whether everybody agreed that if the court decides that self-administered applies to all of these, then the party's over and the case is done. I don't know that, but that was not the issue that was decided.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Justice Kelly.
No problem. Can I turn your attention back to Xanax? Isn't there a narrower argument embedded in your position, and that is the combined effect? So let's assume hypothetically that the methadone was injected, and let's assume hypothetically that Jackson, even though no one argued it, briefed it, or discussed it orally, or was ruled upon, said that that's not self-administered. So let's just assume that. Voluntarily taking the Xanax is clearly self-administered. He admitted to it below. Why does the statute, why isn't that the end of the analysis right there? If the combination of what you start off with, and I mean, a young person can drink a little bit more than an older person in terms of alcohol, so that your starting point doesn't have to be administered self or non-self, whatever your default is. But if you do something voluntarily that takes you into the position where you can't competently navigate a vehicle, so isn't the Xanax point dispositive, and doesn't that even actually eliminate the need to start unpacking whatever anyone was thinking in Jackson?
Your Honor, I think that is the narrowest ground, and it is kind of amazing that this issue has not come up before now, because the self-administered has been part of the statute for a very long time, and I don't know what would happen the next time that it came up. In response to your question, I think the narrowest ground for this court to decide would be that the voluntary ingestion of the Xanax.
So once again, to make my analogy a little more easy to understand, if I take a bunch of antihistamines and it's slowing me down, and then I go to a bar and drink a lot less than ordinarily it would take to make me, you know, dysfunctional, I would be guilty of DUI, would I not?
Yes, you would.
Okay, well then why isn't the Xanax and the alleged non-self-administered methadone exactly that scenario?
It would be, and that would be the narrowest grounds for this court to decide this issue and to affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals, which, of course, is what we're asking this court to do.
Ms. Tyson, I'm sorry, and I hate to go back to this, but did you say the sufficiency of the evidence was not before the Jackson court?
That is my understanding based upon the assignment of error, because the assignment of error was that the trial court had found, basically irrespective of whether the drug had been self-administered or not, the fact that the drug was there, let me start again. The assignment of error is what does this self-administered apply to? Does it apply to all the drugs or just the ones that come after the phrase self-administered? And this court decided that self-administered applied to all of the drugs, and that was the only issue that was decided in Jackson.
And so I think I've heard the argument between Justice Kelsey and counsel, but then why wouldn't it have gone back to determine the sufficiency of the evidence?
Your Honor, and of course that trips you up, tripped me up when I first looked at it as well. And I think that the answer to it is that it could be that all the parties agreed that it was done, that it was not self-administered. I don't know the answer to that, but that was really not what was decided by this court in Jackson. And I think the Court of Appeals was correct in that regard. And we would urge this court to affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals and the Circuit Court of Russell County. Thank you.
Thank you.
If I could quickly address three arguments. First, there was no admission that any of the drugs were taken that they were self-administered. With regard to the Xanax, the argument that the government's talking about is the argument that was made for an instruction that was turned down by the court, which we did not follow up on. The actual instruction given pertained to all drugs in the case.
Did you ever make a hypothesis of innocence assertion in the trial court that the Xanax was not self-administered?
There was nothing argued in front of the jury that would ever suggest that it was self-administered. And the instruction covered all the drugs taken. The other point is, it's clear that if the ruling in this case stands, Jackson is overruled, because Jackson would have been found guilty under the definition from the lower court. And the other thing I'd like to address quickly is the Commonwealth's argument about the defendant having to show proof that he took the drug, or that it was not self-administered. The leading case on point, which they cite, is Williams. And under the Williams case, you have to have four things. One of them, I agree, is that it's solely within the defendant's mind. The other thing is that the statute has to state a qualification, exemption, or exception. They're all in the conjunctive, all four parts. This is not an exception. It's not an exemption. In fact, the drug case, the 18.2-250 to which she referred, does have an exception in it. It talks about the drugs, and then it says, unless you have a prescription. So in order to shift that burden, there has to be some language in the statute which makes an exception. And keeping all of that in mind and seeing that my time is up, thank you, and I would move the court to please dismiss this indictment on appeal.
Thank you. Please call the next case.